From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Coming up on the show today, writer Lisa Servon explores why the United States is seeing the rise of alternative financial services and the decline of banks.
As banks grew bigger and began to see the potential of making money in other ways, for many of them, the individual account holders who just had checking and savings accounts became less important because they were making their money in other ways.
Then singer-songwriter Julian Baker performs at the Pabst next week. In our interview with her from last summer, she talks about the push and pull of being a deeply spiritual person in a secular music world.
It's not diminishing my faith to say that I don't use it as a platform necessarily, or I try not to use it as a soapbox.
And we'll have the latest episode of our storytelling series, Ex-Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Check-cashing stores and payday loan centers have a checkered reputation, to put it mildly. Critics say that their high interest rates and fees take advantage of people who are already financially disadvantaged. But the truth is, these alternative financial systems are proliferating in Wisconsin and around the country.
Writer Lisa Servon wondered why. Servon is a professor of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania. Her new book is called The Unbanking of America: How the New Middle Class Survives. It came out this week, and we reached Lisa Servon on the line from Brooklyn. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So this book takes on a number of paradigms, and I'd like to visit them throughout the course of the interview. And the place I wanted to start, though, is this big kind of question about the typical consumer financial services paradigm is like this idea of banked versus unbanked. And you write that maybe that's not really the way to frame the situation these days.
Right. Right. I think, you know, it's really in the past 10 years that we've begun to use that frame. And I think the banked versus unbanked kind of framework for understanding how people use consumer financial services came about because there was a recognition that there were a lot of people who didn't use bank accounts or didn't use bank accounts exclusively. And that led policymakers to be concerned about that. The assumption was that banks are kind of a tool to achieve middle-class status, that everyone needs a bank account in order to operate fully in the economy. And, I began to take a closer look at that because I suddenly thought, well, what do the people who are not banked, do they not want to be banked, or is there something else going on? The kind of the assumption out there in the media was that people weren't smart enough to be banked, that if only they had a little financial education, then they would do what I'm assuming you and I do, which is to get a bank account. And, the book really started with me kind of going out to try to answer that question and find out why people were choosing not to use a bank account. And what I found out was that for many people, banks just aren't serving them very well, and they're making informed choices many, many times not to use a bank account.
Well, and so what happened in the banking industry that sort of set the consumer financial industry on the road that it's on now, where there is this sort of large alternative, maybe almost parallel financial industry that's out there?
So a couple of things happened. That's a good question. One of them is that bank practices changed, and that those changes were abetted by policy. So, you know, you may have heard, or people may have remembered during the presidential campaign, that there was some talk about reinstating Glass-Steagall. A lot of people might not even know what that was, but there were arguments about that. And Glass-Steagall was legislation that was put in place following the Depression that basically said banks can't engage in risky behavior. You know, they need to protect people's money. Commercial banking, retail banking, and investment banking have to be separate. That legislation was repealed in the 80s, and so suddenly banks were able to do many more things than just have deposit accounts. They were able to create riskier investment strategies. They were also able to branch much more widely. They needed to compete in many ways with other kinds of financial institutions that had arisen, money market funds, et cetera. And they were able to argue successfully to policymakers that they needed to be able to engage in a broader range of strategies in order to be profitable. What that meant was that as banks grew bigger and began to see the potential of making money in other ways, for many of them, the individual account holders who just had checking and savings accounts became less important because they were making their money in other ways. They also switched how they made their money from accounts, from making a lot of their money just from interest. They switched in the 80s to making a lot more of their money from fees. Overdraft fees, which banks hardly did overdraft before the 80s, monthly account fees, minimum requirements of minimum balances, fees to use ATMs, fees to get a new card. Those were all new. And banks realized that they were real money makers. So whereas earlier it was easier to have a bank account and have it be relatively inexpensive, and the argument had been that people who were using check cashers were paying way too much to manage their money, I was really surprised when I went out and worked as a teller and talked to consumers who were using the alternative financial services providers that they told me banks were too expensive. They had experienced increasing monthly charges. Banks were holding their checks longer. One overdraft fee could spiral into hundreds of dollars in fees, and they just couldn't manage that. So that was pretty huge. Those two changes, I think, both the ability for banks to get larger and make money in other ways so that they weren't as dependent on account holders, and this increase in fees made all the difference.
Well, so let's talk about your time working for a check cashing store, because I think one of the things that strikes me in reading about that time is what an eye-opener it was, not just in terms of what goes on there, but the kind of people that use check cashing services.
Right. Yeah, it's a really broad array of people. And, you know, the reason that I went and took the job was that I felt that I couldn't answer this question of why so many people were using services like that without getting really close to the problem. And what I saw were people, many, many people who were working full-time, working steady jobs, but were still living so close to the margin that, for example, they couldn't afford to wait for their checks to clear. People who would come in on Thursdays and Fridays with their paycheck from the last week or 2 weeks, and if they had deposited at a bank, they would have had to wait till Tuesday or Wednesday for that check to clear. Meanwhile, they needed to buy food for their children, they needed to pay the rent, they needed to make sure that their bills would be paid on time. And so from their perspective, they were doing the responsible thing by paying, at that point, 1.95% of the total of their check to get a cash at the check casher and get their bills paid.
That sort of speaks to another paradigm that you write about, this idea of good debt versus bad debt. And
Right. It
sounds like the traditional way of looking at that is kind of going out the window.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we were always told that if we saved for retirement, saved for college, saved to buy a home, that these things were the kind of good debt that we could take on. But what we've seen is that as work has become less reliable in terms of providing people with a living wage, people have had to use debt more and more to finance things like food and clothing and shelter, the basic needs. So we see people with an average of $1,700 of credit card debt that's medical-related because their insurance, either they're not getting insurance through their jobs or their insurance isn't paying for their bills, and using credit in ways that it wasn't necessarily designed for. But, you know, what I'm talking about partly, and I relay this story in my book about a woman who had to take out payday loans. This is kind of a classic story, but it's classic because it's true. A teller who took out payday loans in order to be able to fix her car in order to get to work, right? So the story of good debt versus bad debt is you should never take out a payday loan. You should do anything that you can do to avoid that because the loans are expensive. They're short-term. They cost a lot of money. But for Ariane, the woman whose story I tell in the book, her choice was, do I take out a payday loan and keep my job, or do I not get my car fixed and lose my job? She maybe made a bad decision in terms of taking out an expensive loan, but for her, it was a good decision because she kept her job. And so in this particular moment, we see many, many people who are hardworking people who are making decisions about, should I use my credit card to buy food for my children, or should they go hungry?
Where does transparency come in? That's something that comes up a lot in this book. There are often these high fees or interest rates associated with check cashing or payday loans, but you write that customers feel like they at least know about them up front.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, every bank is required when you open a checking account, for example, to give you a disclosure agreement that states all of the fees, all of the charges. So in those documents are the things that make people most annoyed. The fact that monthly service fees can change in terms of the date that they're levied on, how long it might take to cash a check. And what people appreciate about alternative financial services is that the fees are posted in large letters right there in the store, oftentimes mandated by law. So, you know, the interest rates at a payday lender are in huge font, slapped right up on the wall next to the teller. The application fees are one page long. At the check casher, you know, if you walk into one, and I would encourage people next time you're just walking down the street and you see one to go in, because many people have never set foot into one. There's usually a menu across the top of the teller windows that looks more like a fast food store than a bank, that tells you how much it costs to send a money order, how much it costs to get a check paid, how much it costs to cash your check. So it's very transparent, and people need that kind of predictability. If you walk into a bank, there's almost no signage that tells you what's on offer, how much you're going to pay for a checking account, what your different options are. And so many people have had bad experiences with banks. That, coupled with the media attention following the financial crisis and, for example, the recent Wells Fargo scam, that people are already nervous and wary about banks. They have bad reputations, and many people have personal experiences to back those up.
Did you ever have any qualms as you were working both at the payday loan store where you worked and the check cashing store about playing a role in kind of the tenuous financial situation that your customers were in?
I didn't actually feel uncomfortable with it. I mean, if anything, you know, I my eyes were really open to the kinds of situations that people are facing every day and the kinds of people who are facing those situations. So I would say that the two most eye-opening discoveries for me from being on the front lines were one, just how much knowledge people had about their financial situations and their options, whereas I think the kind of banked-unbanked dichotomy sort of has this this tinge of deficiency about it. If you're unbanked, there's something a little bit wrong. It's like being uneducated or unhealthy, right? That there's something about it that maybe is partly your fault. And I felt like not a single person that I spoke with would have described themselves as unbanked. Some people felt like they would like to have a bank account, people that maybe had one in the past and couldn't afford it now. But that was one thing, was the kind of amount of knowledge that people had. And the second thing that was really eye-opening was the range of people who were using these alternative financial services. You know, I grew up middle class. My parents were teachers. I got a bank account when I was 7 years old, always used a bank. And I just thought that was kind of the norm for people that grew up like I did. And what I discovered was that there were lots and lots of people who were educated, who owned their homes, who were making $50,000 or $75,000 a year, who still couldn't make it day to day, month to month financially, and who were using alternative financial services because they simply had no better options.
The other sort of alternative financial service that exists out there that I was almost completely unaware of, and I suspect a lot of people are these sort of informal peer-to-peer groups that you write about that a lot of people rely on. What are ROSCAs?
So ROSCAs, it's an acronym that stands for Rotating Savings and Credit Association. And I learned about them. I kind of knew about them from just doing research in this field, but I also learned when I worked in the South Bronx that many, many of my customers participated in these things. And what they are informal circles of people, let's say 10 to 15 people, who get together and save and sort of borrow as a group. So usually one person acts as the head of it or the banker, quote-unquote, and everyone in that group decides that they will contribute a certain amount of money every week. So let's say $100 for 10 weeks makes the math easy. Everyone pays in $100, and in week one, one of those 10 people gets the pot. They get the $1,000. And the second week, another person gets the pot of $1,000. And so every person is paying in every week, but the person who's at the front of the queue, the first person that gets the $1,000, for that person it acts as a kind of short-term loan, interest-free, right? They're getting $1,000 and they've only paid in $100. For the person who's at the end of the queue, some people might say, well, why would you want to do that? A lot of people really liked the forced savings aspect of it. They were forced to save that $1,000, and oftentimes when they got that $1,000, they might then buy an appliance that they've been needing for home. They might send it back to family in another country. I interviewed one young woman who was going to community college, and she, when she got the pot every round to pay her tuition at the college, so she timed when she would get it to that. And so people were often really using it to build assets, and they found that it imposed a kind of discipline that they couldn't find otherwise. For some of them, again, they didn't trust banks. They didn't feel like the bank was the place where they wanted to keep their money. They even though it was, from an outside perspective, riskier to give it to this individual, they felt like it was more secure than it would be at the bank. And for some of them, they actually needed to protect that money. They felt like, well, if I have that money at home or in a bank account, then my family members, my friends might put pressure on me to give them the money, and this way I can keep it secure.
Well, and the trust issue seems to speak to something that banks used to be about back when there were many more sort of smaller community-based banks and people knew their banker.
Exactly. And that is something that I found at both the check casher and the payday lender, as well as the woman who I got to know very well in the South Bronx, Blanca, who ran two of these Roscos and also made small loans to people. She also acted as a money guard, meaning that she kept their money and kept it safe for them.
Well, right. So just when it seems like the outlook might be really bleak, you do write about some really innovative ways that people and companies are working to give underserved people access to credit in ways that actually do right by them. Can you give us some examples? What are companies like Fenway Summer and L2C doing?
Yeah, that's one of the really promising things about this current moment is that while we see some people using big data and lots of our consumer data in ways that we wish that they wouldn't, we also see really innovative companies kind of saying like, wow, look at this. We can actually find out a lot more about people and make products that are tailored to their needs and maybe serve them more cheaply and better than other companies are doing. And so L2C is one of my favorites. They've actually been purchased by TransUnion, so now it's TransUnion that's doing this. But L2C was started by a guy named Mike Mondelli, who figured out that there were better ways to measure people's credit scores. So as I'm sure most listeners know, your credit score is the thing that really determines whether you can get credit, whether it's a credit card or a mortgage, and how much you pay for it. And so that score, and sometimes there are big mistakes on people's scores, especially if you have a really common name and you might be confused with a different John Smith. Those scores are really critical, and actually they're being used now for much broader purposes. Landlords use them to see if you'll be able to pay your rent. Employers more and more are using them to determine whether you'll be a good employee or not, something that, in my opinion, should not be legal. But L2C said, you know, we're using really kind of blunt information and incomplete information to create these scores, and especially for people who haven't had a lot of credit, we may not be doing right by them in terms of the accuracy. And so L2C took a much broader view. They looked at things like people's ability not just to pay their credit cards, but to pay their rent and their utilities. They looked at the income coming in and how regular it was, and they took a 30-day look at people's credit as opposed to just a single-day snapshot. So, you know, if you were applying for a credit card right now in early January, your credit might not look so great because you've just been through the holidays and you may be using a lot of, maybe maxing out your credit cards or using a lot more of them than you would be in June. So L2C started taking a broader look at that, and they found, actually, that when they rescore people, many of the people who had subprime credit scores below 600 rise to the prime range, and a lot of people who can't be scored at all, they're called no-file credit score consumers, get credit scores that are prime. And so right there you have one interesting innovation that doesn't cost very much that's giving people access to cheaper, better credit and may enable them to avoid using expensive payday loans.
What would you hope? You know, I would imagine, and, you know, I'm not a market research guy, but I would imagine that many of the people, if not most of the people who read this book will be in upper income brackets, you know,
right,
middle of the middle class or upper middle class or above, and might not necessarily be, you know, even though we find out that some of them actually are taking advantage of these alternative financial services, what would you hope the conversation that ensues among your readers is going to be?
I think it's a few things. I mean, one is to put pressure on policymakers for things like transparency, because even if you're not using an alternative financial services provider, most of the people in audiences that I speak to or people who read my work are not very happy with the service they get from their financial institutions. And I should, you know, when I say banks, I'm kind of using it as a shorthand for big banks. But the four biggest banks right now hold 50% of all deposits in America. They have a lot of control. And the other 6,000-some banks hold the rest. So one thing is to demand that regulators, that government actually make banks and other financial institutions more accountable to people. And I talk about a couple of ways to do this. One is that every financial product should have a fact box on it that looks like the nutrition fact boxes on your cereal or your maple syrup or the bread that you buy, that shows you that if you're looking at checking accounts or prepaid cards or any other product, you should be able to compare them in a very easy way and see what the costs are going to be. Another suggestion on the transparency front would be for any financial institution to get a letter grade the same way that restaurants do in many big cities, A, B, or C. And those restaurants are graded on their health standards. Well, financial institutions should be graded based on the service and price and transparency that they provide to their customers. The other thing is that people can actually also, aside from pushing government to make financial institutions serve us better, I think many people say that they're really fed up with their financial institutions, but they don't see a better way out. And so I also want people to know that they do have choices. On average, for example, people that have credit unions pay much less in fees than people who use banks. Almost everyone can find a credit union that would work for them, and many credit unions now and smaller, more local banks are reimbursing people for fees when they use out-of-network ATMs. Many people think, like, well, I need to go to a big bank because they're on every corner, and they have their ATMs will be more useful for me as I travel. But I think a lot of credit unions and smaller banks have figured out ways to compete. And so I think it's not only about whether I'm paying more at a check casher or at a payday lender, but it's also about whether I have my money in an institution that supports my values, that acts ethically, and actually is more transparent and customer friendly.
Well, Lisa Servan, it is thought-provoking stuff and really interesting reading. Thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Lisa Servan's new book is called The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. It just came out this past week. Servan is a professor of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania, and we reached her in Brooklyn.
Keep listening. The introspective, vulnerable songwriting of musician Julianne Baker is just ahead when Lake Effect Weekend continues right here on Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's been about a year and a half since Julianne Baker released her debut record, Sprained Ankle, and she's already found a devoted and passionate following. In a matter of months, Baker went from a regular opening act to a consistent headliner, playing for audiences of individuals who each have a unique connection to her music.
Baker's only 21 years old, and her debut record resonates with her demographic deeply. She sings boldly of sadness, anxiety, and her spirituality. A review in The New Yorker said listening to her songs is like eavesdropping on someone's prayers. Her music is known for its sad and quiet nature, although Baker is anything but.
Baker returns to the opening act world, opening for Death Cab for Cutie's Ben Gibbard this coming Tuesday at the Pabst Theater. But last summer, she was in town for Summerfest, and Lake Effect contributor Adam Miller spoke with her then about the tug of war between the secular music world and her own strong spiritual leanings.
I don't want to say it's difficult. It's only difficult theoretically, but I think that approaching it, knowing other people's reservations about the topic is what makes it easier for me. It's not diminishing my faith to say that I don't use it as a platform necessarily, or I try not to use it as a soapbox. Obviously, there are inherent things about being a Christian that I don't want to say obliged, but you're motivated to share it with people. And obviously, like, the kind of Christianity that I'm familiar with, I want to share that with people. I want to express to people that it's not the judgmental, institutionalized kind of Leviathan that the media portrays, that it's more something that guides my life than being a more compassionate human being, being a more understanding human being, especially with, like, recent events. It makes me motivated to try to shift people's perceptions into this is something that outside the context of institutionalized traditionalism can be an opportunity to lead your life in a more compassionate, loving way. I think you have to be aware of those things because for me, my experience has been positive, but I know other people have been scorned by it, and it's like an exercise in deferring to other people and not forcing your way.
Do you find yourself having conversations with, you know, other musicians that you're playing with or fans that approach you? Do you find yourself having conversations about your faith?
Well, with other musicians, yes. And I think what's interesting is that a lot of the musicians I speak to, you know, not just in the Southern scene, which seems predictable or expected, but also, you know, musicians from the Northeast or the West Coast, they grew up with a religious background, and they offer insights, even if they, you know, profess to be atheists or they don't necessarily ascribe to the belief system I do, it's so interesting hearing their insights. And I think within an artistic community, people are a lot more ready to open those dialogues in a place where we can suspend, you know, personal investment in it and just talk about other people's experience. I do talk about it a lot with people at shows will say, I also struggle with spirituality or religion or wherever they fall on the spectrum of how defined and specific you want to get with the entity you believe in. It's cool to me to be able to have those conversations and not necessarily cool because I'm like, you know, forcing them within a box of being the same as me, but I just like hearing that it's stimulating people's thoughts, however they follow through that thought train.
How do you feel as singer-songwriter, as a Christian? How do you feel being asked about your faith so often?
Well, in one regard, I feel like it's a great opportunity because there are so many people who regrettably get a microphone and then use it to make Christianity analogous to hatred or a certain political agenda. And I'm grateful that I have an opportunity to maybe dispel that or maybe be an example of someone who is diametrically opposed to that belief. But I worry that it's kind of a burden to have people say, like, what's your take on Christianity, and then risk speaking for the entire dogma. You know, I think what's most important is its individuality and the, like, relational aspect of religion and, like, Christendom in general. And it's like, this is just me, you know, like, it's an open dialogue.
You've gone from being a typical opening act to a regular headliner, and just like a matter of months, I mean, 2016's been a pretty crazy year for you. What has that growth been like?
It's been a little overwhelming, in a good way.
In what way?
I mean, it's very difficult to acclimate to a different kind of schema of music, mm-hmm. and music being your occupation and your job.
Because you're also going to school right now, correct?
Well, so it got to a point where I was like, I was in school last fall, touring on the weekends. And on the weekends, I always tell stories, I would take like a plane to L.A. and be typing my paper on a plane and land, drive straight to my class. And then the spring semester, I was on the road doing online courses, and right now it's summer. And
right.
I'm taking some time off from school because, I mean, the knowledge you gain in school is about getting you to a self-supporting, ideal career. But fortunately, it's like now I can do music, and for the time being, whether that's only the next 6 months and then everybody gets tired of it, or if it's sustainable for the rest of my life, I just want to take advantage of those opportunities for now.
I think that your growth has a lot to do with the fact that the opening shows that you've played are really, it's a really captivating and intimate show. You really just draw the crowd in. In that moment, whenever you're creating these loops and you're just kind of sitting in an atmosphere that you've created, what sort of things are you feeling? What's going through your mind?
There are times when I get very apprehensive about being on stage because I'm shy. I try to overcome that with being outgoing and chipper to sort of abate the...
How's that going?
Like that. It goes well. I mean, it's forcing yourself into those situations that it's like an impetus for growth, right? So if I'm nervous and I'm introverted, but I go to the merch table anyway, I almost always end up having an interaction with someone that I'm glad I had. It is a positive thing. There's a takeaway, there's a conversation, there's a relationship built that I'm glad for. And it's the same way with performing, you know, like sometimes I get worried about what the crowd is feeling because ultimately the songs were written by me, for me, and about me. And that's kind of a self-involved endeavor. But when I'm performing, I know, especially headlining, like, okay, these people listen to the record. They care about my art and they don't have to. They could be anywhere else right now.
I know you left hours ago. I still haven't moved yet. I knew you were gone months ago. But I can't think of anyone else. I should have said something, something, something. But I couldn't find something. So I just said nothing, nothing, nothing. So I watched you drive away.
And it's interesting that you say that the songs are about you, written for you, but it's no secret that your fan base, has really emotionally connected on a personal level to the music that you put out.
That's true, and it's not as if I was never aware that other people might hear these songs, but especially with the songs on Sprained Ankle, I was just writing them, and I thought that the only people that would ever hear them were maybe my friends at like basement show or a bar show or a house show, and I didn't have any aspirations for them, and so I didn't write them trying on purpose to establish a bond with the listener.
Whenever you perform these songs for the first time after you've just been playing them, privately by yourself or maybe just for some friends, are you intimidated by how personal the content is whenever you're performing it for people?
I am, or I was. At this point, I think I've kind of gotten to where I've come to terms with it because I used to think this is too personal and it's almost going to be too much and make people uncomfortable. And then I thought, well, but it's valuable. It's valuable to be vulnerable. It's kind of like, who's going to give ground first? You experience that dynamic in anything, in forming a new friendship or any kind of relationship, in a conversation. If you divulge a little bit of yourself, it establishes trust for someone else to give or someone else to feel more comforted. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, yeah, if someone comes up to me and says, that song really meant a lot to me, or I related to this song, I absolutely 100 times will play it, even if it is a little bit embarrassing or if I'm like, these are very personal, but they're true. But I try to be goofy on stage or personable because I want to separate those two things and not wallow in it to where it's an artificial persona of someone who's still living in that kind of mental rut. Because, yeah, those are real experiences that happened, but it's okay. We can confront them and talk about them, and that's what gives me license to be a goofy, personable, well-adjusted individual, is being open about those things.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Of course, yeah. It was my pleasure.
Julian Baker is a singer-songwriter from Memphis, Tennessee. Her debut album, Sprained Ankle, is out now. She spoke with Lake Effect contributor Adam Miller last July.
Baker will open for Death Cab for Cutie's Ben Gibbard this coming Tuesday at the Pabst Theater. There's more information about that show at WUWM.com.
Take one last break and then return with the latest episode of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal stories.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And this is Ex Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend here on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Rachel Owens in the studio once again with Ex Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney. Welcome back.
Hello again. How are you?
Doing well. Staying warm. Trying to stay healthy too.
Excellent. Yes, me too. I think I've been staving away something short of pneumonia, but I'm telling you, a hot toddy a night is the great way to get rid of
it. I'm going to get that recipe.
Yes, please do.
This week we have MLK Junior Day right around the corner, and that seems to really tie in with this week's theme.
So yes, Ex Fabula is really excited and happy to be a part of Martin Luther King Junior Day coming up on Monday the 16th. We are going to be featuring a session within a 9 to 5 p.m. program located at the MLK Library over on Locust Street. And it's going to be a fantastic day, family friendly, where children and adults can come and learn and take part in some really interesting activities. It's going to be a lot of entertainment. And at 2 o'clock, actually between 2 p.m. and 2:45, we're going to be featuring a couple of our Ex Fabula fellows. They're telling and sharing stories under the theme of speaking up. So it'll be a really great day to attend to. I invite all of Milwaukee to come.
Yeah, a nice thing that a lot of people hopefully will have that day off and they'll be able to make that event. So for this week, our first story is former fellow or a fellow?
Yes, our first story is going to be told today by L.G. Shanklin Flowers. She is one of our fellows, and she's about to tell a story of which she told at one of our events back in October, and we'll get into more of our fellowship program in a couple minutes. But this is really the basic theme is throwing responsibility of racial issues back onto people of color, opposed to standing up and taking action. So let's listen to L.G. Shanklin Flowers tell her story.
It was a wonderful summer day. The sun was shining. There was meat on the grill, cold drinks in the cooler. We all gathered to celebrate Robin's birthday. And I thought, this is going to be a good day, even though I didn't know most of the people there and there were very few people of color. Nothing in my youth prepared me to be in largely white spaces. I was warned against being too trusting, being too open, and told often that I should be prepared to be betrayed. In spite of that, or because of that, I began to notice through high school and college and early employment that I found myself in hostile environments, but I somehow made it work. And in spite of the challenges, I developed friendships and felt good about my ability to operate in spaces that I hadn't been trained to operate in. So here I was at this party, mostly white folk, most of whom I didn't know. But I knew I liked Robin, and I liked her partner. And so they introduced me to their friends, and there were a few other people there that I knew as well. And I got reconnected with Robin's brother, who a couple of months earlier had helped me move. So, you know, we were all getting into the party, and suddenly the music was changing, and I had remembered I had brought a couple of CDs, and so I passed them on. And as people started dancing and moving, you know, to the beats, over the sound of the music, I heard this question: who brought this jungle music? Suddenly, well, there was that too. That happened. People froze. People tried to hide their gasps. People were looking around, looking for someone to do something. And it suddenly hit me. They were all looking at me to do something about what had just happened. And I can remember that I handled it. I actually got really pretty proficient at being able to handle white situations in which stuff always comes up. And so I made it very clear to him that it wasn't okay what he said. And I challenged his proclamations about it was really only a joke. And that he somehow had permission because he had black friends and they bantered the N-word around. It was not okay. And I let him know that. And so I got approached by him and his sister, and he apologized profusely. And I assured him that while what he said was not okay, I was fine. And then things kind of relaxed and people went about their business of having fun at this birthday party. Later, I reflected on that experience and I got furious. And when I was crafting this story, I got furious. I got in touch with my fury. Where were my friends? Where were my allies? Where were all those people who witnessed what happened? I was attacked, and yet I was expected to handle it. And so the fury often gets tapped because I find myself in spaces in which people, the expectation, particularly liberal white spaces, in which the expectations are that people would come forward, make a stand, do what they need to do to interrupt. It doesn't happen. People looked awkward, felt uncomfortable, were frozen, were scared, and all these other accompanying feelings, and yet the expectation was that I would manage it and I would handle it. I continue to find myself in spaces, and I continue, in spite of the messages I got it as a young one, to move forward in the world out of trust and out of deep connection. And yet, I also have an expectation that people will move out of their feels, that's F-E-E-L-S, out of their feelings, and come forward and be powerful in interrupting. Because I deserve to be able to move and be in any space and know that it'll be safe and that there'll be people backing me in that process.
And that was L.G. Shanklin Flowers, one of our Exfabula Fellows, sharing her personal experience. It's so important.
I think that's a kind of story that a lot of us can relate to, whether we want to admit to it or not.
Yes.
We've found ourselves on one side of that equation or the other. And so it's really great to hear someone just speak that out loud and to, you know, make it real, I think, for everybody in the room.
Definitely. And that's what the Exfabula Fellowship is all about. So these people who are sharing their experience are not just people from the greater Milwaukee area. I consider them leaders in this community because they're the ones who are sharing their personal experiences, whether they be easier stories or tougher stories to tell, and inspire conversations with a community that's not necessarily able to be able to speak about it, no less do something about it. So we do have another Exfabula Fellowship event coming up very soon. Of course, we are going to be at the MLK Library over on the 16th. But we'll also have an event based upon white fragility. And that's going to be held on Saturday, January 21st, 9:30 till noon at the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion. And in this particular event, not unlike the other events that we have for our fellowship series, we're going to begin with stories told by our Exfabula Fellows. And then we're going to break into facilitated circles. And then we'll end it on a mini workshop, learning some practical skills on how to address white fragility. So basically, giving the tools and the comfort level to stand up and take part in becoming more of a community. And with that being said, we are going to jump into our next story, which is told by another fellow. Her name is Jen Heppner. And this story deals a little bit more with privilege and racism in the workplace. So here's Jen Heppner.
One of the stories that I was sharing with one other individual involved an incident when I was a program director at a larger agency about 10 years ago, and my boss at the time told me to fire a very qualified person because she was black, and to hire in her place someone I had already deemed unqualified for the position because she was white. She wanted a white person in that spot. And I didn't do it. I stopped her evil plot, and I covered myself from any retaliation. And then after I shared that story, the other fellow asked me some questions. And one of the questions she asked me was, you know, she said, well, Jen, you know, what are you? You mentioned the race of the employee and the other candidate. You didn't say your race or the race of your boss. And I said, you're right, that's something that I should talk about too. Both of us are white females. And then she asked me another question, which was, what were your credentials when you got hired as that program director? And I was really irritated by that question because I thought, my story has nothing to do about when I got hired. It's about how I swooped in and saved the day, right? But then I was like, well, you know, this is the process, so I'll do it. And I listed off my immaculate list of credentials, right? But this continued to irritate me throughout the rest of the session and when I went home. And I did not sleep all night because part of our process at the Exfabula Fellowship was we learned that when it starts to feel uncomfortable, probably getting down to something. So I thought, I better look at that. I started reading old books, textbooks from when I was in school, studying social stratification and feminism and social justice and a bunch of different articles, and finally it dawned on me, I had gotten that program director job because I was white. Had nothing to do with my list of credentials, right? Because that boss who had told me to fire this perfectly qualified black woman and hire the unqualified white woman had been the same person who had put final stamp of approval on my being hired for the program director job, and clearly she didn't care about my credentials. The only credential she cared about was my skin color, being white. And this really felt like a kick in the stomach. It was horrible to feel like I got a job in that fashion, but even the worst thing was that for all those 10 years, it had never once crossed my mind that I had gotten the job based on anything other than merit. Never once, even though it should have been right there. I should have recognized it, I didn't. So I, in addition to getting the job, I had the privilege of believing and being so sure that I had gotten it based on my credentials, my experience, my resume, how I had performed in the interview. And, you know, being a part of this fellowship helped me to realize that there were things going on in me that I was completely unaware of, and I feel like I was just, I don't know, I was hiding them from myself almost, because I think now the reason why I was so irritated by her questioning my credentials, and the reason why I didn't mention that I was white, and the reason why in the first place my boss thought I would cooperate with her in this plot, was because it was very obvious to her that I had been hired based on race, and she thought it would have been obvious to me, but it wasn't. And I think deep down, maybe I knew. Deep down, I knew it, but I wasn't going to let myself think about it or become aware of it. And other questions come up for me now based on that, like what else is going on that I'm pushing away or not looking at? In what other ways am I benefiting from this kind of stuff? Because I had always thought I don't benefit from racism. But I got something pretty valuable there. That was a very important job for me. And getting that job helped me to get the job that I have now, you know? And so this process and being a part of the fellowship and sharing the stories and dialoguing about them afterwards has opened up a whole new avenue for me of an area that I have to investigate about myself and to share with others on this topic. Thank you.
And that was Jen Heppner sharing her personal experience with racism in the workplace.
I was really impressed with how she took some time to come to that realization about feeling that she had gotten that job just based on merit and then having to come to the conclusion that that wasn't necessarily the case, and allowing someone, again, that safe space to be able to speak that truth. And I think that's so important and really gets to the heart of your fellowship program.
It really does. It helps people open up and start thinking about your personal life as a white person and start quantifying what fragility is and what privileges you have received throughout your lifetime. So it's nothing but wonderful, great learning opportunities that this fellowship series is offering. And again, I would like to invite everybody in Milwaukee to take part in this at some point. We have numerous workshops and events for our fellowship series. All of them do require pre-registration ahead of time, so please go to exfabula.org for more information and reserving your spot and taking part.
Thanks again so much, Leah, for coming by, and we look forward to another week of stories.
Thank you so much.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up our show today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. Be sure to tune into the weekday version of our show as well at 10 in the morning.
It is all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Weekend All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.